This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One-Click Digital present Nutshell by Ian McEwan. Narrated by Rory Kinnear.
Oh, God. I could be bounded in a nutshell and count myself a king of infinite space. Were it not that I have bad dreams. Shakespeare, Hamlet. 1. So here I am, upside down in a woman, arms patiently crossed, waiting. Waiting and wondering who I'm in, what I'm in for. My eyes close nostalgically when I remember how I once drifted in my translucent body bag, floated dreamily in the bubble of my thoughts through my private ocean in slow-motion somersaults, colliding gently against the transparent bounds of my confinement, the confiding membrane that vibrated with, even as it muffled, the voices of conspirators in a vile enterprise. That was in my careless youth. Now, fully inverted, not an inch of space to myself, knees crammed against belly, my thoughts, as well as my head, are fully engaged. I've no choice. My ear is pressed all day and night against the bloody walls. I listen, make mental notes, and I'm troubled. I'm hearing pillow talk of deadly intent, and I'm terrified by what awaits me, by what might draw me in. I'm immersed in abstractions, and only the proliferating relations between them create the illusion of a known world. When I hear blue, which I've never seen, I imagine some kind of mental event that's fairly close to green, which I've never seen. I count myself an innocent, unburdened by allegiances and obligations, a free spirit despite my meagre living room. No one to contradict or reprimand me, no name or previous address, no religion, no debts, no enemies. My appointment diary, if it existed, notes only my forthcoming birthday. I am, or I was, despite what the geneticists are now saying, a blank slate. But a slippery, porous slate no schoolroom or cottage roof could find use for, a slate that writes upon itself as it grows by the day and becomes less blank. I count myself an innocent, but it seems I'm party to a plot. My mother, bless her unceasing, loudly squelching heart, seems to be involved. Seems, mother. No, it is. You are involved, I've known from my beginning. Let me summon it, that moment of creation that arrived with my first concept. Long ago, many weeks ago, my neural groove closed upon itself to become my spine, and my many million young neurons, busy as silkworms, spun and wove from their trailing axons the gorgeous golden fabric of my first idea. A notion so simple it partly eludes me now. Was it me? Too self-loving. Was it now? Overly dramatic. Then something antecedent to both, containing both, a single word mediated by a mental sigh or swoon of acceptance, of pure being, something like this? Too precious. So, getting closer, my idea was to be. Or if not that, its grammatical variant is. This was my aboriginal notion, and here's the crux. Is. Just that. In the spirit of es muss sein, the beginning of conscious life was the end of illusion, the illusion of non-being, and the eruption of the real. The triumph of realism over magic, of is over seems. My mother is involved in a plot. And therefore I am too, even if my role might be to foil it. Or if I, reluctant fool, come to term too late, then to avenge it. But I don't whine in the face of good fortune. I knew from the start, when I unwrapped from its cloth of gold my gift of consciousness, that I could have arrived in a worse place, in a far worse time. The generalities are already clear, against which my domestic troubles are, or should be, negligible. There's much to celebrate. I'll inherit a condition of modernity, hygiene, holidays, anaesthetics, reading lamps, oranges in winter, and inhabit a privileged corner of the planet, well-fed, plague-free Western Europe. Ancient Europa, sclerotic, relatively kind, tormented by its ghosts, vulnerable to bullies, unsure of herself, destination of choice for unfortunate millions. My immediate neighbourhood will not be palmy Norway, my first choice on account of its gigantic sovereign fund and generous social provision, nor my second, Italy, on grounds of regional cuisine and sun-blessed decay, and not even my third, France, for its Pinot Noir and jaunty self-regard. Instead, I'll inherit a less than United Kingdom, ruled by an esteemed elderly queen, where a businessman prince, famed for his good works, his elixirs, cauliflower essence to purify the blood, and unconstitutional meddling, waits restively for his crown. This will be my home, and it will do. I might have emerged in North Korea, where succession is also uncontested, but freedom and food are wanting. How is it that I, not even young, not even born yesterday, could know so much, or know enough to be wrong about so much? I have my sources. I listen. My mother, Trudy, when she isn't with her friend Claude, likes the radio and prefers talk to music. Who, at the internet's inception, would have foreseen the rise and rise of radio, or the renaissance of that archaic word wireless? I hear, above the launderette din of stomach and bowels, the news, wellspring of all bad dreams. Driven by a self-harming compulsion, I listen closely to analysis and dissent. Repeats on the hour, regular half-hourly summaries don't bore me. I even tolerate the BBC World Service and its puerile blasts of synthetic trumpets and xylophone to separate the items. In the middle of a long, quiet night, I might give my mother a sharp kick. She'll wake, become insomniac, reach for the radio. Cruel sport, I know, but we are both better informed by the morning. And she likes podcast lectures and self-improving audiobooks. Know Your Wine in 15 parts, biographies of 17th century playwrights and various world classics. James Joyce's Ulysses sends her to sleep, even as it thrills me. When, in the early days, she inserted her earbuds, I heard clearly, so efficiently did sound waves travel through jawbone and clavicle, down through her skeletal structure, swiftly through the nourishing amniotic. Even television conveys most of its meagre utility by sound. Also, when my mother and Claude meet, they occasionally discuss the state of the world, usually in terms of lament, even as they scheme to make it worse. Lodged where I am, nothing to do but grow my body and mind, I take in everything, even the trivia, of which there is much. For Claude is a man who prefers to repeat himself, a man of riffs. On shaking hands with a stranger, I've heard this twice, he'll say, "Claude," as in Debussy. How wrong he is. This is Claude, as in property developer, who composes nothing, invents nothing. He enjoys a thought, speaks it aloud, then later has it again, and, why not, says it again. Vibrating the air a second time with this thought is integral to his pleasure. He knows you know he's repeating himself. What he can't know is that you don't enjoy it the way he does. This, I've learnt from a Reith lecture, is what is known as a problem of reference. Here's an example both of Claude's discourse and of how I gather information. He and my mother have arranged by telephone, I hear both sides, to meet in the evening. Discounting me, as they tend to, a candle-lit dinner for two. How do I know about the lighting? Because when the hour comes and they are shown to their seats, I hear my mother complain. The candles are lit at every table but ours. There follows in sequence Claude's irritated gasp, an imperious snapping of dry fingers, the kind of obsequious murmur that emanates, so I would guess, from a waiter bent at the waist, the rasp of a lighter. It's theirs. a candlelit dinner. All they lack is the food. But they have the weighty menus on their laps. I feel the bottom edge of Trudy's across the small of my back. Now I must listen again to Claude's set piece on menu terms, as if he's the first ever to spot these unimportant absurdities. He lingers on pan-fried. What is pan but a deceitful benediction on the vulgar and unhealthy fried? Where else might one fry his scallops with chili and lime juice? In an egg timer? Before moving on, he repeats some of this with a variation of emphasis. Then, his second favourite, an American import, steel cut. I'm silently mouthing his exposition even before he's begun, when a slight tilt in my vertical orientation tells me that my mother is leaning forwards to place a restraining finger on his wrist and say, sweetly, divertingly, "Choose the wine, darling. Something splendid." I like to share a glass with my mother. You may never have experienced, or you will have forgotten, a good Burgundy, her favourite, or a good Sancerre, also her favourite, decanted through a healthy placenta. Even before the wine arrives, tonight a Jean-Max Roger Sancerre, at the sound of a drawn cork, I feel it on my face like the caress of a summer breeze. I know that alcohol will lower my intelligence. It lowers everybody's intelligence. But oh, a joyous, blushful Pinot Noir, or a gooseberried Sauvignon, sets me turning and tumbling across my secret sea, reeling off the walls of my castle, the bouncy castle that is my home. Or so it did when I had more space. Now I take my pleasures sedately, and by the second glass my speculations bloom with that license whose name is poetry. My thoughts unspool in well-sprung pentameters, end-stopped and run-on lines in pleasing variation. But she never takes a third, and it wounds me. "I have to think of baby," I hear her say as she covers her glass with a priggish hand. That's when I have it in mind to reach for my oily cord, as one might a velvet rope in a well-staffed country house, and pull sharply for service. "What-ho? Another round here for us friends?" But no. She restrains herself for love of me. And I love her. How could I not? The mother I have yet to meet, whom I know only from the inside. Not enough. I long for her external self. Surfaces are everything. I know her hair is straw fair, that it tumbles in coins of wild curls to her shoulders the white of apple flesh, because my father has read aloud to her his poem about it in my presence. Claude, too, has referred to her hair in less inventive terms. When she's in the mood, she'll make tight braids to wind around her head, in the style, my father says, of Yulia Tymoshenko. I also know that my mother's eyes are green, that her nose is a pearly button, that she wishes she had more of one, that separately both men adore it as it is, and have tried to reassure her. She's been told many times that she's beautiful, but she remains sceptical, which confers on her an innocent power over men. So my father told her one afternoon in the library. She replied that if this was true, it was a power she'd never looked for and didn't want. This was an unusual conversation for them, and I listened intently. My father, whose name is John, said that if he had such a power over her, or women in general, he couldn't imagine giving it up. I guessed, from the sympathetic wave motion which briefly lifted my ear from the wall, that my mother had emphatically shrugged, as if to say, "So men are different, who cares?" Besides, she told him out loud, whatever power she was supposed to have was only what men conferred in their fantasies. Then the phone rang. My father walked away to take the call, and this rare and interesting conversation about those that have power was never resumed. But back to my mother, my untrue Trudy, whose apple-flesh arms and breasts and green regard I long for, whose inexplicable need for Claude predates my first awareness, my primal is, and who often speaks to him, and he to her, in pillow whispers, restaurant whispers, kitchen whispers, as if both suspect that wombs have ears. I used to think that their discretion was no more than ordinary amorous intimacy, but now I'm certain. They airily bypass their vocal cords because they're planning a dreadful event. Should it go wrong, I've heard them say, their lives will be ruined. They believe that if they're to proceed, they should act quickly and soon. They tell each other to be calm and patient, remind each other of the cost of their plan's miscarriage, that there are several stages, that each must interlock, that if any single one fails, then all must fail, like old-fashioned Christmas tree lights, this impenetrable simile from Claude, who rarely says anything obscure. What they intend sickens and frightens them, and they can never speak of it directly. Instead, wrapped in whispers, are ellipses, euphemisms, mumbled aporia, followed by throat clearing and a brisk change of subject. One hot, restless night last week, when I thought both were long asleep, my mother said, suddenly, into the darkness, 2 hours before dawn, by the clock downstairs in my father's study, "We can't do it." And straight away Claude said flatly, "We can." And then, after a moment's reflection, "We can." 2. Now to my father, John Cairncross, a big man, my genome's other half, whose helical twists of fate concern me greatly. It's in me alone that my parents forever mingle, sweetly, sourly, along separate sugar phosphate backbones, the recipe for my essential self. I also blend John and Trudy in my daydreams. Like every child of estranged parents, I long to remarry them, this base pair, and so unite my circumstances to my genome. My father comes by the house from time to time, and I'm overjoyed. Sometimes he brings her smoothies from his favourite place on Judd Street. He has a weakness for these glutinous confections that are supposed to extend his life. I don't know why he visits us, for he always leaves in mists of sadness. Various of my conjectures have proved wrong in the past, but I've listened carefully, and for now I'm assuming the following. That he knows nothing of Claude, remains moonishly in love with my mother, hopes to be back with her one day soon, still believes in the story she has given him that the separation is to give them each time and space to grow and renew their bonds. That he is a poet without recognition, and yet he persists. That he owns and runs an impoverished publishing house, and has seen him to print the first collections of successful poets, household names, and even one Nobel laureate. When their reputations swell, they move away, like grown children, to larger houses. That he accepts the disloyalty of poets as a fact of life, and, like a saint, delights in the plaudits that vindicate the Cairncross Press. That he's saddened, rather than embittered, by his own failure in verse. He once read aloud to Trudy and me a dismissive review of his poetry. It said that his work was outdated, stiffly formal, too beautiful. But he lives by poetry, still recites it to my mother, teaches it, reviews it, conspires in the advancement of younger poets, sits on prize committees, promotes poetry in schools, writes essays on poetry for small magazines, has talked about it on the radio. Trudy and I heard him once in the small hours. He has less money than Trudy, and far less than Claude. He knows by heart 1,000 poems. This is my collection of facts and postulates. Hunched over them, like a patient philatelist, I've added some recent items to my set. He suffers from a skin complaint, psoriasis, which has rendered his hands scaly, hard and red. Trudy hates the look and feel of them, and tells him he should wear gloves. He refuses. He has a 6-month lease on 3 mean rooms in Shoreditch, is in debt, is overweight, and should exercise more. Just yesterday I acquired, still with the stamps, a penny black. the house my mother lives in, and I in her, the house where Claude visits nightly, is a Georgian pile on boastful Hamilton Terrace, and was my father's childhood home. In his late 20s, just as he was growing his first beard, and not long after he married my mother, he inherited the family mansion. His dear mother was long dead. All the sources agree, the house is filthy. Only clichés serve it well, peeling, crumbling, dilapidated. Frost has sometimes glazed and stiffened the curtains in winter. In heavy rains, the drains, like dependable banks, return their deposit with interest. In summer, like bad banks, they stink. But look, here in my tweezers is the rarest piece of all, the British Guiana. Even in such a rotten state, these 6,000 aching square feet will buy you £7 million. Most men, most people, would never permit a spouse to eject them from under their childhood eaves. John Cairncross is different. Here are my reasonable inferences. Born under an obliging star, eager to please, too kind, too earnest, he has nothing of the ambitious poet's quiet greed. He really believes that to write a poem in praise of my mother, her eyes, her hair, her lips, and come by to read it aloud, will soften her, make him welcome in his own house. But she knows that her eyes are nothing like the Galway turf, by which he intended very green, and since she has no Irish blood, the line is anemic. Whenever she and I listen, I sense in her slowing heart a retinal crust of boredom that blinds her to the pathos of the scene. A large-hearted man pleading his cause without hope in the unmodish form of a sonnet. 1,000 may be hyperbole. Many of the poems, my father knows, are long, like those famed creations of bank employees, The Cremation of Sam McGee and The Wasteland. Trudy continues to tolerate the occasional recitation. For her, a monologue is better than an exchange, preferable to another turn round the unweeded garden of their marriage. Perhaps she indulges him out of guilt, what little remains. My father speaking poetry to her was once, apparently, a ritual of their love. Strange that she can't bear to tell him what he must suspect, what she's bound to reveal, that she no longer loves him, that she has a lover. On the radio today, a woman recounted hitting a dog, a golden retriever, with her car on a lonely road at night. She crouched in her headlights by its side, holding the dying creature's paw through its spasms of frightful pain. Large brown, forgiving eyes stared into hers all the while. She took in her free hand a rock and dashed it several times against the poor dog's skull. To dispatch John Cairncross would take only one blow, one coup de vérité. Instead, as he begins to recite, Trudy will assume her bland, listening look. I, however, attend closely. We generally go to his poetry library on the first floor. A mantelpiece clock with rackety balance wheel makes the only sound as he takes his usual chair. Here, in the presence of a poet, I permit my conjectures to flourish. If my father looks towards the ceiling to compose his thoughts, he'll see deterioration in the Adam-style designs. Damage has spread plaster dust like icing sugar across the spines of famous books. My mother wipes her chair with her hand before she sits. Without flourish, my father draws breath and begins. He recites fluently, with feeling. Most of the modern poems leave me cold. Too much about the self, too glassily cool with regard to others, too many gripes in too short a line. But as warm as the embrace of brothers are John Keats and Wilfred Owen, I feel their breath upon my lips, their kiss. Who would not wish to have written Candied apple, quince and plum and gourd, or The pallor of girls' brows shall be their pall? I picture her from across the library through his adoring eyes. She sits within a big leather armchair that dates from Freud's Vienna. Her lithe, bare legs are partly, prettily tucked beneath her. One elbow is bent against the armrest to support her drooping head. The fingers of her free hand drum lightly on her ankle. The late afternoon is hot. The windows are open. The traffic of St. John's Wood pleasantly hums. Her expression is pensive. Her lower lip looks heavy. She moistens it with a spotless tongue. A few blonde ringlets lie damply on her neck. Her cotton dress, loosely cut to contain me, is pale green, paler than her eyes. The steady work of pregnancy goes on, and she is weary, agreeably so. John Cairncross sees the summer's flush on her cheeks, the lovely line of neck and shoulder and swollen breasts, the hopeful knoll that is me, the sunless pallor of her calves, the unwrinkled sole of one exposed foot, its line of diminishing, innocent toes, like children in a family photo. Everything about her, he thinks, brought to perfection by her condition. He can't see that she's waiting for him to leave, that it's perverse of her to insist on him living elsewhere in this, our third trimester. Can he really be so complicit in his annihilation? Such a big fellow. 6'3", I've heard, a giant with thick black hair on mighty arms, a giant fool to believe it's wise to grant his wife the space she says she needs. Space? She should come in here, where lately I can barely crook a finger. In my mother's usage, space, her need for it, is a misshapen metaphor, if not a synonym. For being selfish, devious, cruel. But wait, I love her. She's my divinity, and I need her. I take it back. I spoke in anguish. I'm as deluded as my father. And it's true. Her beauty and remoteness and resolve are one. Above her, as I see it, the library's decomposing ceiling releases a sudden cloud of spinning particles that glimmer as they drift across a bar of sunlight. And how she glimmers against the cracked brown leather of the chair where Hitler or Trotsky or Stalin might have sprawled in their Viennese days when they were but embryos of their future selves. I concede. I'm hers. If she commanded it, I too would go to Shoreditch and nurse myself in exile. No need for an umbilical cord. My father and I are joined in hopeless love. Against all the signs, her terse responses, her yawns, her general inattention, he lingers into the early evening, in hopes, perhaps, of dinner. But my mother is waiting for Claude. At last she drives her husband away by declaring her need to rest. She'll see him to the door. Who could ignore the sorrow in his voice as he makes his tentative goodbyes? It pains me to think he would endure any humiliation in order to spend some minutes longer in her presence. Nothing, save his nature, prevents him doing what others might do. Precede her to the master bedroom, to the room where he and I were conceived, sprawl on the bed or in the tub among bold clouds of steam, then invite his friends round, pour wine, be master of his house. Instead, he hopes to succeed by kindness and self-effacing sensitivity to her needs. I hope to be wrong, but I think he'll doubly fail, for she'll go on despising him for being weak, and he'll suffer even more than he should. His visits don't end, they fade. He leaves behind in the library a field of resonating sadness, an imagined shape, a disappointed hologram still in possession of his chair. Now we're approaching the front door as she sees him off the premises. These various depredations have been much discussed. I know that one hinge of this door has parted with the woodwork. Dry rot has turned the architrave to compacted dust. Some floor tiles have gone, others are cracked. Georgian in a once colourful diamond pattern, impossible to replace. Concealing those absences and cracks, plastic bags of empty bottles and rotting food. Spilling underfoot, These are the very emblems of household squalor. The detritus of ashtrays, paper plates with loathsome wounds of ketchup, teetering tea bags like tiny sacks of grain that mice or elves might hoard. The cleaning lady left in sadness long before my time. Trudy knows it's not a gravid woman's lot to heave garbage to the high-lidded wheelie bins. She could easily ask my father to clean the hall, but she doesn't. Household duties might confer household rights. And she may be at work on a clever story of his desertion. Claude remains, in this respect, a visitor, an outsider, but I've heard him say that to tidy one corner of the house would be to foreground the chaos in the rest. Despite the heat wave, I'm well protected against the stench. My mother complains about it most days, but languidly. It's only one aspect of domestic decay. She may think that a blob of curd on his shoe, or the sight of a cobalt-furred orange by the skirting will shorten my father's goodbyes. She's wrong. The door is open, he straddles the threshold, and she and I are just inside the hall. Claude is due in 15 minutes. He sometimes comes early. So Trudy is agitated but determined to appear sleepy. She's standing on eggshells. A square of greasy paper that once wrapped a slab of unsalted butter is caught under her sandal and has oiled her toes. This she will soon relate to Claude in humorous terms. My father says, "Look, we really must talk." "Yes, but not now." "We keep putting it off. I can't begin to tell you how tired I am. You've no idea what it's like. I've simply got to lie down." "Of course. That's why I'm thinking of moving back in, so I can—"
"Please, John, not now. We've been through this. I need more time. Try to be considerate. I'm bearing your child, remember? This isn't the time to be thinking of yourself."
"I don't like you being alone here when I could—"
"John!"
I hear his sigh as he embraces her as closely as she'll permit. Next, I feel her arm go out to take his wrist, carefully avoiding, I should think, his afflicted hands, turn him, and gently propel him towards the street.
"Darling, please, just go."
Later, while my mother reclines, angry and exhausted, I recede into primal speculation. What kind of being is this? Is Big John Cairncross our envoy to the future? The form of a man to end wars, rapine and enslavement, and stand equal and caring with the women of the world? Or will he be trampled into oblivion by brutes? We shall find out. 3. Who is this Claude? This fraud who's wormed in between my family and my hopes. I heard it once and took note. The dull-brained yokel. My full prospects are dimmed. His existence denies my rightful claims to a happy life in the care of both parents, unless I devise a plan. He has entranced my mother and banished my father. His interests can't be mine. He'll crush me. Unless, a wisp of a word, ghostly token of altered fate, bleating little iamb of hope, it drifts across my thoughts like a floater in the vitreous humour of an eye. Mere hope. And Claude, like a floater, is barely real. Not even a colourful chancer, no hint of the smiling rogue. Instead, dull to the point of brilliance, vapid beyond invention, his banality as finely wrought as the arabesques of the Blue Mosque. Here is a man who whistles continually, not songs, but TV jingles, ringtones, who brightens a morning with Nokia's mockery of Tarraga, whose repeated remarks are a witless, thrustless dribble, whose impoverished sentences die like motherless chicks, cheaply fading.
who washes his private parts at the basin where my mother washes her face, who knows only clothes and cars, and has told us 100 times that he would never buy or even drive such or such, or a hybrid, or that he only buys his suits in this, no that, Mayfair Street, his shirts in some other, and socks from, he can't recall, if only, but. No one else ends a sentence on a but. That stale, uncertain voice. My entire life I've endured the twin torments of his whistling and his speaking. I've been spared the sight of him, but that will soon change. In the dim-lit gore of the delivery room, Trudy has decided that he, not my father, will be there. When I emerge to greet him at last, my questions will remain, whatever form he takes. What is my mother doing? What can she want? Has she conjured Claude to illustrate the enigma of the erotic? Not everyone knows what it is to have your father's rival's penis inches from your nose. By this late stage, they should be refraining on my behalf. Courtesy, if not clinical judgment, demands it. I close my eyes. I grit my gums. I brace myself against the uterine walls. This turbulence would shake the wings off a Boeing. My mother goads her lover, whips him on with her fairground shrieks. Wall of death? On each occasion, on every piston stroke, I dread that he'll break through and shaft my soft-boned skull and seed my thoughts with his essence, with the teeming cream of his banality. Then, brain-damaged, I'll think and speak like him. I'll be the son of Claude. But rather trap me inside a wingless Boeing's mid-Atlantic plunge than book me one more night of his foreplay. Here I am, in the front stalls, awkwardly seated upside down. This is a minimal production, bleakly modern, a two-hander. The lights are full on, and here comes Claude. It's himself, not my mother, he intends to undress. He neatly folds his clothes across a chair. His nakedness is as unstartling as an accountant's suit. He wanders about the bedroom, upstage, downstage, bare-skinned through the soft drizzle of his soliloquy. His aunt's pink birthday soap that he must return to Curzon Street. A mostly forgotten dream he had. The price of diesel. It feels like Tuesday, but it's not. Each brave new topic rises groaning to its feet, totters, then falls to the next. And my mother? On the bed, between the sheets, partly dressed, wholly attentive, with ready hums and sympathetic nods. Known only to me, under the bedclothes, a forefinger curls over her modest clitoral snood and rests a sweet half-inch inside her. This finger she gently rocks as she concedes everything and offers up her soul. I assume it's delicious to do so. Yes, she murmurs through her sighs. She too had her doubts about the soap. Yes, her dreams are also lost to her too soon. She too thinks it's Tuesday. Nothing about diesel, a small mercy. His knees depress the unfaithful mattress that lately held my father. With able thumbs, she hooks her panties clear. Enter Claude. Sometimes he'll call her his mouse, which seems to please her. But no kisses, nothing touched or fondled or murmured or promised, no licks of kindness, no playful daydreams. Only the accelerating creak of the bed, until at last my mother arrives to take her place on the wall of death and begins to scream. You might know this old-fashioned attraction of the funfair. As it turns and accelerates, centrifugal force pins you against the wall while the floor beneath you drops giddily away. Trudy spins faster. Her face is a blur of strawberries and cream and a green smear of Angelica where her eyes once were. She screams louder, then, after her final rising, falling shout and shudder,
I hear his abrupt, strangled grunt. The briefest pause. Exit, Claude. The mattress dips again, and his voice resumes, now from the bathroom. A reprise of Curzon Street, or the day of the week, and some cheerful essays on the Nokia theme. One act, 3 minutes at most, no repeats. Often she joins him in the bathroom, and, without touching, they expunge each other from their bodies with absolving hot water. Nothing tender, no fond dozing in a lover's tangled clasp. During this brisk ablution, minds swabbed clean by orgasm, they often turn to plotting. But in the room's tiled echo against running taps, their words are lost to me. Which is why I know so little of their plan. Only that it excites them, lowers their voices, even when they think they're alone. Nor do I know Claude's surname. By profession, a property developer, though not as successful as most. The brief and profitable ownership of a tower block in Cardiff was one peak of his achievement. Wealthy? Inherited a seven-figure sum, now down, it seems, to his last quarter million. He leaves our house around 10, returns after 6. Here are two opposing propositions. The first, a firmer personality lurks inside a shell of blandness. To be this insipid is hardly plausible. Someone clever and dark and calculating is hiding in there. As a man, he's a piece of work, a self-constructed device, a tool for hard deception, scheming against Trudy even as he schemes beside her. The second, he's as he appears. The cockle has no morsel. He's as honest a schemer as she, only dimmer. For her part, she'd rather not doubt a man who hurls her over the gates of paradise in under 3 minutes. Whereas I keep an open mind. My hope of discovering more is to wait up all night to catch them in one more disinhibited aubade. Claude's untypical, "we can," first caused me to doubt his dullness. 5 days have since passed, and nothing. I kick my mother awake, but she won't disturb her lover. Instead, she clamps a podcast lecture to her ears and submits to the wonders of the internet. She listens at random. I've heard it all. Maggot farming in Utah, hiking across the Burren, Hitler's last chance offensive in the Ardennes, sexual etiquette among the Yanomami, how Poggio Bracciolini rescued Lucretius from oblivion, the physics of tennis. I stay awake, I listen, I learn. Early this morning, less than an hour before dawn, there was heavier matter than usual. Through my mother's bones, I encountered a bad dream in the guise of a formal lecture. The state of the world. An expert in international relations, a reasonable woman with a rich, deep voice, advised me that the world was not well. She considered two common states of mind, self-pity and aggression. Each one a poor choice for individuals. In combination, for groups or nations, a noxious brew that lately intoxicated the Russians in Ukraine, as it once had their friends, the Serbs, in their part of the world. We were belittled, now we will prove ourselves. Now that the Russian state was the political arm of organized crime, another war in Europe no longer inconceivable. Dust down the tank divisions for Lithuania's southern border, for the North German plain. The same potion inflames the barbaric fringes of Islam. The cup is drained, the same cry goes up. We've been humiliated, we'll be avenged. The lecturer took a dim view of our species, of which psychopaths are a constant fraction, a human constant. Armed struggle, just or not, attracts them. They help to tip local struggles into bigger conflicts. Europe, according to her, in existential crisis, fractious and weak as varieties of self-loving nationalism sip that same tasty brew. Confusion about values, the bacillus of anti-Semitism incubating, immigrant populations languishing, angry and bored. Elsewhere, everywhere, novel inequalities of wealth, the super-rich a master race apart, ingenuity deployed by states for new forms of brilliant weaponry, by global corporations to dodge taxes, by righteous banks to stuff themselves with Christmas millions. China, too big to need friends or counsel, cynically probing its neighbours' shores, building islands of tropical sand, planning for the war it knows must come. Muslim-majority countries plagued by religious puritanism, by sexual sickness, by smothered invention. The Middle East, fast breeder for a possible world war, and foe of convenience the United States, barely the hope of the world, guilty of torture, helpless before its sacred text, conceived in an age of powdered wigs, a constitution as unchallengeable as the Quran. Its nervous population obese, fearful, tormented by inarticulate anger, contemptuous of governance, murdering sleep with every new handgun. Africa, yet to learn democracy's party trick, the peaceful transfer of power. Its children dying, thousands by the week, for want of easy things. Clean water, mosquito nets, cheap drugs. Uniting and levelling all humanity, the dull old facts of altered climate, vanishing forests, creatures and polar ice. Profitable and poisonous agriculture, obliterating biological beauty. Oceans turning to weak acid. Well above the horizon, approaching fast, the Uranus tsunami of the burgeoning old, cancerous and demented, demanding care. And soon, with demographic transition, the reverse. Populations in catastrophic decline. Free speech no longer free. Liberal democracy no longer the obvious port of destiny. Robots stealing jobs. Liberty in close combat with security. Socialism in disgrace. Capitalism corrupt, destructive and in disgrace. No alternatives in sight. In conclusion, she said, these disasters are the work of our twin natures. Clever and infantile. We've built a world too complicated and dangerous for our quarrelsome natures to manage. In such hopelessness, the general vote will be for the supernatural. It's dusk in the second age of reason. We were wonderful, but now we are doomed. 20 minutes. Click. Anxiously, I finger my cord. It serves for worry beads. Wait, I thought. While it lies ahead of me, what's wrong with infantile? I've heard enough of such talks to have learned to summon the counter-arguments. Pessimism is too easy, even delicious, the badge and plume of intellectuals everywhere. It absolves the thinking classes of solutions. We excite ourselves with dark thoughts in plays, poems, novels, movies, and now in commentaries. Why trust this account when humanity has never been so rich, so healthy, so long-lived? When fewer die in wars and childbirth than ever before? And more knowledge, more truth by way of science was never so available to us all? When tender sympathies for children, animals, alien religions, unknown distant foreigners swell daily? When hundreds of millions have been raised from wretched subsistence? When, in the West, even the middling poor recline in armchairs, charmed by music, as they steer themselves down smooth highways at four times the speed of a galloping horse? When smallpox, polio, cholera, measles, high infant mortality, illiteracy, public executions, and routine state torture have been banished from so many countries? Not so long ago, all these curses were everywhere. When solar panels and wind farms and nuclear energy and inventions not yet known will deliver us from the sewage of carbon dioxide, and GM crops will save us from the ravages of chemical farming and the poorest from starvation. When the worldwide migration to the cities will return vast tracts of land to wilderness, will lower birth rates and rescue women from ignorant village patriarchs. What of the commonplace miracles that would make a manual labourer the envy of Caesar Augustus? Pain-free dentistry, electric light, instant contact with people we love, with the best music the world has known, with the cuisine of a dozen cultures. We're bloated with privileges and delights, as well as complaints. And the rest who are not will be soon. As for the Russians, the same was said of Catholic Spain. We expected their armies on our beaches. Like most things, it didn't happen. The matter was settled by some fireships and a useful storm that drove their fleet round the top of Scotland. We'll always be troubled by how things are. That's how it stands with the difficult gift of consciousness. Just one hymn to the golden world I'm about to possess. In my confinement, I've become a connoisseur of collective dreams. Who knows what's true? I can hardly collect the evidence for myself. Every proposition is matched or cancelled by another. Like everyone else, I'll take what I want, whatever suits me. But these reflections have been distracting me, and I've missed the first words of the exchange I've stayed awake to hear, the aubade. The alarm was minutes from sounding. Claude murmured something. My mother replied, then he spoke again. I come round, I press my ear to the wall. I feel a disturbance in the mattress. The night has been warm. Claude must be sitting up, pulling off the T-shirt he wears to bed. I hear him say he's meeting his brother this afternoon. He's mentioned this brother before. I should have paid more attention. But the context has generally bored me. Money, accounts, taxes, debts. Claude says all his hopes are on this poet he's signing up. Poet? Very few people in the world sign up a poet. I only know of one. His brother. My mother says, oh yes, this woman, forgotten her name, writes about owls.
Owls? A hot topic is owls. But I should see him tonight.
She says slowly, I don't think you should. Not now.
Well, he'll come round here again. I don't want him bothering you. But...
My mother says, nor do I, but this has to be done my way. Slowly.
There's a silence. Claude takes his phone from the bedside table and preemptively turns off the alarm. Finally, he says,
if I lend my brother money, it'll be good cover.
But not too much. We won't exactly be getting it back.
They laugh. Then Claude and his whistling make for the bathroom. My mother turns on her side and goes back to sleep, and I'm left in the dark to confront the outrageous fact and consider my stupidity. 4. When I hear the friendly drone of passing cars and a slight breeze stirs what I believe are horse chestnut leaves, when a portable radio below me tinnily rasps and a penumbral coral glow, a prolonged tropical dusk dully illuminates my inland sea and its trillion drifting fragments, then I know that my mother is sunbathing on the balcony outside my father's library. I know, too, that the ornate cast-iron railing of oak leaf and acorn design is held together by historical layers of black paint and should not be leaned on. The cantilevered shelf of crumbling concrete where my mother sits has been declared unsafe, even by builders with no interest in the repairs. The balcony's narrow width permits a deck chair to be placed obliquely, almost parallel to the house. Trudy is barefoot, in bikini top and brief denim shorts that barely allow for me. Pink-framed heart-shaped sunglasses and a straw hat top this confection. I know this because my uncle, asked her on the phone to tell him what she was wearing. Flirtatiously, she obliged. A few minutes ago, the radio told us it was